Okay. Then we continue. And we continue with these elements, which are the more theoretical notions after having described the why, having described how we do comparative research in criminology in different ways, we come now to some theoretical notions that are important for this interpretive paradigm. First, there is this idea of that criminology is very much in the realm of Western presuppositions. Stan Cohen made the first comment, in fact, that the Western theories, the American theories, only in fact are, he posed the question the other way around. He said, what use are the instruments, the theoretical instruments of criminology, if we study intifada? Because that was his field of research in the early 80s. Then Cohen just moved to Israel, was very active in the Peace Now movement, and posed himself the question, how useful is criminology in this context? The answer, not very much. Why? Because it presupposes a democratic state, it presupposes a police that is more or less accountable, and it does not take into account that, in fact, the country is governed by a military. And it doesn't deal, this was his major point, it doesn't deal with mass murder. Criminology is about one citizen murdering another, one man raping one woman. But it does not deal with mass murder or rape as an instrument of war. This is the case always in war. The biggest humiliation for the enemy is raping the wives of the enemy. Criminology has no answer to that kind of rape. So he argues, in fact, yes, criminology is about murder and it's about rape, but only in peacetime and only in one-to-one context, but not in a mass. Biko Agozino, he is from Nigeria. He works in the US though. And he says, well, what's the use of criminology in West Africa? I will come back to that later tomorrow, because then I will deal with this different perspectives. Tomorrow I will focus a little bit America versus Europe, Western world, Africa, and Latin America, just to see some fundamental differences. But just a brief story here about Agozino's work is that, in fact, he argues criminological theories first are very much oriented at, well, the same political system, capitalism, but a regulated capitalism, not the very savage capitalism that you have in developing countries. It's about a democratic rule of law that is more or less controlled. It's not about child soldiers, etc., etc., etc. So basically a very similar critique. And he makes also the argument, for example, he criticizes a lot of the work of people like Travis Hirschi and Gottfredson, because he said, well, it's about the nuclear family and it's about how parents raise their children. But 80% of the world does not have nuclear families. It's the extended family model. And the social control is by anybody who is older than the kid. I mean, it's completely missing the point in 80% of the countries of the world. Morrison is also studying the genocides. He made a book, it's just been translated into in Spanish, about theories, and he very much criticizes theories of modernization, civilization, that are very much embedded in our ideas of development of countries. And he argues that in a slightly Baumannian style, that in fact modernity has brought the largest atrocities. Once we had the fight from man to man with a sword, the casualties were much lower than in modernism, whereas the theories would predict that modernization, civilization, would bring forward less lower levels of violence, which is the case in the whole Elias or Elias tradition of criminology by Peter Spierenburg, for example. I don't know how known he is, but well, people say, well, the punishments, it's the sociology of punishment, that, and Garland is dealing a lot with his work as well. The punishments have become less harsh because of the process of modernization and civilization. Morrison is completely the opposite. He said, well, no, modernization and civilization has led to more violence. It's just not violence from one person to another, but it's the violence of states, or it's the violence of ethnic groups. So group violence has increased. So again, Cohen posing the very basic question as the first one: how useful are criminological insights in order to analyze the Intifada? Agosino: criminology misses the point because there is a Western bias at every conceivable level. Wayne Morrison argues the whole ideas of criminological theories is very much embedded in ideas about civilization and modernization. I see the opposite. It's not leading to less violence, it's leading to more violence. This is one theoretical notion that I think for an interpretative cultural global criminology is very important. That you see the biases of criminology that are not that visible at first sight, but if you look at it, it has very strong presuppositions on society, on social control, that are not the same all over the globe. Vincenzo Ruggiero has made the point of the critical cosmopolitanism. He lent it from Ulrich Beck, but he gave it another turn himself. And he very much focuses on an old debate in the philosophy of law, for example: to what extent are human rights universal, or to what extent are human rights a Western invention? He takes very much the perspective of diversity, the diversity perspective, that human rights mean something else in every country. So we can speak about human rights in China, but we should not make the mistake of thinking that human rights have the same content and have the same content as they have in Western Europe. On a more abstract level, Susanne Karstedt, German criminologist working in England, again a traveller, and broadened that perspective a little bit to the old idea on complete relativism, where in fact you cannot speak about values at all, because values would be different in every part of the world, which lead to a cultural relativism, which is mostly also not very helpful, because then you say, well, okay, yes, forced marriages, yes, it's in their culture. Okay, yes, the domination of men by women, oh yeah, we can say nothing about it, it's in their culture. And so the extreme relativism is also not very helpful, because it leaves aside, for example, that there are also people, mainly women, who are very much opposed to patriarchic traditions themselves as well. So the absolute relativism is not helpful. On the other hand, the absolute essentialism is not very helpful either. Because essentialism would claim that there are universal values, and that the values are the same in every country. Now, I presume that one of these universal values is that nobody likes it if they hit you on the head. I mean, that seems pretty universal. But the reasons why and how you conceive an idea, well, of human rights or of let's say emancipation of women, that varies very much. What we see as the liberation of women to go out and wear short skirts and etc. Is seen basically as emancipation, whereas in large part of the world it is seen as decadence or as the commodification or the sexualization of women, i.e. the exploitation. So the essentialism misses the point as well, because the same phenomena are in different cultural contexts interpreted differently. So the point is, for comparative criminology, not being too relativist and not being too essentialist. So that's another important theoretical notion to bear in mind. Now, the notion developed by Ulrich Beck of methodological nationalism is in fact the flip side of his idea of critical cosmopolitanism. We all have a kind of nationalist bias in our head, because what we take with us is the baggage which we have been educated. You cannot help to bring yourself into your research. You're always present in your research. So the point is to be aware of that, that you bring yourself, that you bring your own upbringing in it, that you bring your own cultural context in it. It's not that you can avoid it, because you are who you are, and you look with the eyes you have, but what Beck argues is that you have to have an awareness that you are biased, and in that way correct it as much as possible. And the last theoretical notion I want to point at, which is very important in interpretive paradigm and comparative chronology, is that globalization is not only an economic phenomenon, but globalization is very much a cultural phenomenon. This is very much visible in the work of Zygmunt Bauman. You know all his Liquid series, maybe, Liquid Modernity, Liquid Fears, even Liquid Sex. Everything is liquid. What does Bauman mean by that? That the fixed identities we have, are crumbling down due to globalization. And he even explains the rise of new nationalist or regionalist traditions as an urge for identity, which had got lost in the process of globalization. So it's easy to say we are globalized, we are global citizens, we are citizens of the world, but there is also this sense of belonging. You want to belong to something. So the Catalan case is a good example, I think, of this. You are part of the European Union, because you see, well, it's all these new banners, Catalonia, a new state in Europe, right? Okay, if Rajoy doesn't oppose, but this is also, you see yourself both as a part of the world, but you say, but who am I? If I'm only a part of the world, it's not enough. And Appudarai, which is an Indian anthropologist, cultural anthropologist, who also works in the States at the moment, has developed the idea that we live, all of us live in different realities at the same time. Later in this paper, that will be probably tomorrow, I will come back to his work. Well, this theoretical notions automatically lead to epistemological issues, and that very much reflects very common mistakes made in comparative criminology. At first point that I have to mention is that in many comparative research, we overstress differences. coming close to the idea of essentialism. This is typical for Islam. This is typical for the south of the US. This is typically Asian. It's probably not. And the closer you are to a certain countries, the more striking the differences seem. So the more on the nitty-gritty empirical level you are, the more strongly one tends to focus on differences, which are mostly overstated differences, because we have very often more in common than things that divide us. But when we focus on comparisons, we tend to focus on the differences. Or the opposite, if we have a very macro sociological perspective, we tend to overstress similarities. Now, a lot of the globalization literature is guilty of that, guilty of that other mistake, of overstressing similarities. Yeah? With the process of globalization, we all eat our hamburgers at McDonald's, and we all wear Nikes, and we're all the same. That's not true either. It's not true that even when the stores have become the same, and the leisure gear has become the same, and even the television programs have been more or less the same, it doesn't mean that there is no difference. History and economy shapes our values very much as well. So overstressing similarities is the flip side. If you are very much focusing on the empirical nitty-gritty level, you tend to stress difference. If you focus on processes of globalization, you tend to gloss over the empirical level and you tend to overstress similarities. This is the third bullet point, the problem of labels that look the same but are not the same. And you can say thinking of a good example. Yeah, well, for example, you young people, silly examples are always the most simple. Yeah? You have young guys who greet themselves like this, you know, it's the gang symbol. For many people, young people in Girona, is kind of being cool, being streetwise, being seen as a tough guy. The meaning for somebody from the Bronx is the brother in the same kind of situation. Other good example is that, yeah, we wear tattoos nowadays, increasingly, right? But the tattoos in our world are fashion. Tattoos in a Maori culture, what's tattoo? Tattoo, yeah. Tattoo, isn't it? But tattoos traditionally have a very strong cultural meaning, and you can read, in fact, somebody's social status, somebody's position, married or not married, you can read a lot. So even when you say, well, they have tattoo and we have tattoo, oh, it's the same. No, the cultural meaning can be completely different. So don't focus on the surface, look at it, look at what is behind it. Reject everything that smells like general theory. You know from Gottfriedson and Hirschi, general theory of crime, it's a lie. General theories don't exist. It's a very ethnocentric conception. General theory claims to be valid for every type of crime in every scene and every setting. It's not true. Take, for example, the idea that their theory of Gottfriedson and Hirschi is very much based on ideas on the nuclear family, which in 80% of their countries is not there. Others, you can transform a little bit. You have to be very careful in how to use theory. For example, the institutional enemy theory of Roosevelt and Messner, I don't know how known that is. is that it's the more radical version of Merton, let's put it that way. It's taking Merton to the 21st century, and Merton focusing very much on the American dream in the 1930s, and reflecting, let's say, the cultural values embedded in the American dream, which would cause more strain than more traditional societies. Roosevelt and Messner argue that in the current American competitive society, that's even stronger, more of a problem than it is in the 1930s. Now, you could say that this structural enemy, this institutional enemy, the more competitive a society is, the more crime, the more criminal activities will be there. You can't translate it into different settings. Routine activities by Felsen.
Thank you.
By Felsen, the same story. It's just that the routines are different, but the idea, the notion of routine activities can be transformed. Even Gotthardson and Hirschi has elements that you may be able to use, but don't take it as the panorama. Always adapt, because this is, I think, the most important lesson that you can learn in criminology. Never take anything as the model and use it. It's always adapted to national circumstances. But in comparing countries, we still miss a lot. And this is the global dimension. And the global dimension is increasingly important because in many crimes, borders are not important anymore. The best example I can give you is cybercrime. The internet is by definition not bound to national borders. It doesn't matter. It's, bless you, it's even committed in different countries. Take child pornography, for example, which is spread through the internet. It's produced, let's take Thailand. It's hosted a lot from the US because the legislation is the weakest, or from the typical tax paradises, Malta, or so the hosting is again in another countries, and the consuming countries are again different. So where is the locus of the crime? It's very hard to tell. The illegal logging of the rainforests, the Solomon Islands north of Australia, is already the first example where the process of desert formation cannot be turned around anymore. So what was a rainforest is becoming a desert very, very quickly. The Amazons, not yet because it's quite a bit bigger, but if we continue in this way, is also one big soy crop, one global soy field. And there's no rainforest anymore. Is that the problem of the Solomon Islands? Is that the problem of Brazil? I don't think so, because it has a lot to do with global change, with climate change. Also there, you see, well, it has major global consequences and local consequences. The indigenous people who live in the forest, well, in fact, their lifestyle is exterminated. The lungs of the world become smaller and smaller and smaller. And in fact, we buy all the timber for our nice tables. So in fact, also a global problem. Or the oil industry, who exploits oil wells in, let's say, Nigeria, polluting the complete Niger Delta, or the gold mining in Colombia, or in Suriname, which is a Dutch colony, completely polluted soil. The images are terrible. Is that a problem of that country? Is it a problem of whose problem is it? No, it's mostly multinational corporations who do it. It's Repsol, it's Shell, it's Cargill, it's the large multinational corporations, i.e. another global problem. And there are many, many problems that have nothing to do with national borders anymore, but are still very harmful for many people. Hence, I would say, from a comparative perspective, we have to move to a more global perspective. Now, this is the last slide I will deal with. You can do this kind of global criminology also in different ways. You can take the meta level, like Bauman, for example, the cultural meaning of crime and the liquid modernity with liquid fears, etc. That the hybridity as such and the unclearness of norms provokes a new kind of anomie, if you like. But you can also take a more empirical look. You can study local consequences of globalization, global youth cultures, for example, and music, how music cultures, how gang cultures are being, graffiti cultures are being used, the same graffiti, the same tags, the same kind of symbols and rituals are being exported from one country to another. You can focus on McDonaldization, which is the word that George Ritzer has developed for the kind of new mechanic production we all imitate. We can focus on, well, what happened if there is a civil war in some African countries in the streets of Girona, or of new security measures, because there is a terrorist risk. For example, just to give an example, if the ships, Rotterdam is a port city, very big port, biggest port of Europe. Well, of course, they had security systems. But after 9/11, with the threat of terrorism, they had to allow either American staff in the port of Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, to secure the harbor, or the ships could not visit American harbors. You see, so also a global phenomena that had very strong local consequences. Vice versa, the same global implications of local and national and regional developments. Civil wars, as I said, civil wars always lead to migration. Oil production. What do we do? How is our addiction to oil affecting the globe? And this is very much in line with the most famous Catalan I know, Manuel Castells, working in America also. He's studying very much on global flows. So not the production, not the recipient country, but we have to follow the line from production to consumption. It has been done a lot in the drug sphere, for example. It has been done a lot to do a case study on Colombia or in Peru. Follow the whole lines. What is the production process? What is the economy, the drugs economy in Colombia or in Peru or whatever? Who are the ones who transport? Who are the mullahs who carry this stuff? Who are the transportation companies who transport it? Who receive it in mainly Galicia or in Holland, etc., etc. The same with the war in Afghanistan, because I think 80% of all heroin comes from Afghanistan. How the war in Afghanistan affected the production of heroin, and how the Turks, who were generally the transition country, transported to Europe, for example, affected by it. All kinds of very interesting studies from production to consumption. And I think that is also a very interesting path to pursue in criminology. Today I will leave it with that. I think we have some time. for questions, and we will continue tomorrow just on the same point as we stopped today. Yes? Okay. You're welcome. Como quieras. Si no es en catalán, mejor. Sí. Pero parla poco a poco. Sí. Significa que con la modernidad líquida significa que no tenemos la herencia de los padres y la cultura que teníamos, es el único que somos, ¿no? Compartimos muchas partes de la cultura global, y eso es similar con los miedos que tenemos. Los miedos, tenemos mucho miedo, pero a veces no sabemos por qué tenemos miedo. Por el terrorismo, bueno, ¿cuántos terroristas hay en general? Son miedos muy abstractos. Tenemos miedo para el marroquí en la calle. ¿Cuántos marroquíes violentos hemos encontrado en nuestras vidas? Son miedos a un nivel más abstracto. Tenemos mucho miedo, pero no para cosas muy concretas. No basado en experiencias personales. Es más miedos provocando por los medios de comunicación, he oído de mi vecina que tiene un abuelo, que tiene un amigo, ¿qué pasó? Es más transmitido en una manera muy indirecta los miedos. Eso quiere decir.
Porque yo creo que estamos entendiendo la literatura sociológica. Liquid modernity es como este concepto de la humanidad que está más relacionado con la sociedad postmoderna.
Sí.
Como decir, sociedad postmoderna o tal, capitalismo, y que las cosas no son sólidas, sino que son líquidas, que ya no hay referentes sólidos, que todo es mucho más cambiable.
Sí, ¿no? Sí, exacto.
Entonces, con esa idea que se ha puesto súper de moda,
este mismo nivel del metanivel, de cómo se construye, o sea, la cultura del miedo, también vemos un poco, por ejemplo, que sale un poco la cultura de cómo el miedo se vende.
Sí, sí.
Porque
sí.
Está todo el 11S, Europa no tiene nada que ver con el 11S,
sí.
Y aún así aquí todos,
sí.
Miedo de marroquíes, miedo
sí,
de
sí, sí,
es
sí,
por
sí,
cómo
sí,
está vendido. O sea, quizá no es a consecuencia de la globalización, sino de que todos los políticos, todos los medios de comunicación han vendido la misma historia.
Sí. Era más o menos mi charla de ayer por el tercer año, traficando con el miedo. Creo que el 11 de septiembre o el 11 de marzo, o bueno, los ataques terroristas han influenciado nuestro pensamiento a seguridad hasta alto nivel, pero no ha cambiado el mundo totalmente. Hay un deseo para sensación, por los medios de comunicación, por ejemplo, quiere vender diarios. Si ves la tele, empieza siempre con accidentes y drama, ¿no? No hay un programa de tele o un artículo en diario interesante. Hoy todo está muy bien, ¿no? No vende. Eso es uno. Para vender el miedo asusta. Queremos un poco ser asustados también, nosotros. Otro es políticos que quieren controlar. Y para ellos es muy útil si pasó algo muy ministerio muy dramático para provocar medidas de seguridad que ya querían instalar hace tiempo, pero no encontraban un basis social. Y el miedo es muy útil, y traficar miedo es muy útil para establecer un basis para introducir medidas muy punitivas, por ejemplo, ¿no? Eso es un libro que puedo recomendar, que están traduciendo ahora en castellano, pero ya existe en inglés. Es Murray Lee, Inventing Fear of Crime, inventando el miedo del crimen. Es un muy buen análisis. Y otro que es muy importante en esta línea de pensamiento es de Jonathan Simon, Governing Through Crime, en cual Simon describe la realidad en California, donde políticas en varios niveles sociales, de medio ambiente, de gentrificación, el trabajo, sí, son en realidad vendido por el papel que va a producir una sociedad más segura. Pero la verdad es que no tiene nada que hacer con eso. Es que, bueno, es el interés para gente que quieren construir nuevos shoppings, por ejemplo. Pero dicen, bueno, tenemos que asegurar, es siempre el argumento es, hacemos con esta iniciativa, hacemos la sociedad más segura. Y Simon, en el contexto de California, muestra muy bien que hay intereses económicos, intereses sociales, intereses morales atrás o detrás estos argumentos que eso va a hacer la sociedad más segura. ¿Era más o menos una respuesta?
Sí. Más global, sí. Y que nos obliga a repensar el objeto de estudio de la tecnología.
Exactamente.
Como el crimen organizado es más nacional, como efectos medioambientales que son mucho más dañinos. Es decir, que el objeto de estudio de la
exactamente.
Está
cambiando. Amplia el campo de trabajo para criminólogos mucho. Pero lo que es extraña es que nunca pensábamos que es un problema que las teorías llegan de otros países. Al inicio, ¿qué son las primeras teorías en la criminología? Era Lombroso, Italia. Era de Guéry, Francia. Nunca hemos puesto esas preguntas. Y después usamos Shaw y McKay, usamos Mazza, usamos todos los americanos, sin preguntarnos qué tiene que hacer con nuestra sociedad. Es un gran error, creo, en la criminología. Y la segunda es, como digas, que como criminólogos nos hemos concentrado a problemas relativamente pequeños y hemos dejado los problemas criminales más graves. Sí, eso es el argumento clave. Los dos, ¿no? Sí, 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 es un... Es una buena cuestión, buena pregunta, pero es muy difícil. Y hay una línea en la criminología cuando vas a congresos criminológicos internacionales, la criminología global y la criminología verde, que es la parte de la criminología global que se ocupa con temas ecológicos. Sí, es una tradición muy importante ahora en la criminología. El segundo parte de tu pregunta es más difícil, porque no hay un gobierno mundial. Hay las Naciones Unidas, hay el World Bank, hay International Monetary Fund, hay instituciones, pero una gobernanza global no hay. Y eso es exactamente el problema en el desarrollo de políticos contra crímenes globales, porque no hay autoridades globales, no hay jurisdicciones globales. Y eso es exactamente el problema. Tomamos el problema del crímenes ecológicos. ¿Qué tenemos? Tenemos el Tratado de Kioto, de 97, creo, 98. 80% de los del crimen ecológico es cometido por China y por los Estados Unidos. Exactamente estos dos países no han firmado. Tenemos el Trato de Río de Janeiro, lista de CITES, no sé si es conocido, que prohíbe el comercio en plantas protegidas, animales protegidos, en sustancias que afectan el ozono, químicas dañosas, radioactivas. Es un treaty, que es un tratado. Es un tratado. Varios países lo han firmado con voluntad, pero muchos no. Y tampoco no hay la legislación. Muchos de contratos de Tratado de Río, por ejemplo, está en Holanda también en las leyes penales o las leyes administrativas, pero no en Sierra Leone o no en Colombia. Y eso es exactamente el problema con la criminología global. La parte de policy, de política, es muy difícil porque no hay autoridades mundiales. Y por eso, y si China y Estados Unidos dicen que no, que pasa nada. Eso, sí. Eso es el único que podemos hacer. Y eso hacemos como crimen. Eso, bueno, no quiero exagerar el rol de comunidad criminológica, pero lo poco que podemos hacer es eso, ¿sí? Mostrar el daño. Mostrar el daño. Y un poco de lobby también para hacerlo visible. Las ONGs pueden usar investigación criminológica, por ejemplo, o podemos involucrarnos nosotros mismos en los ONGs en este nivel. Pero eso es más el camino para seguir que el camino gubernamental, porque no hay un gobierno mundial. Y nos vemos muy bien, ni siquiera lo tenemos en el contexto europeo. Mira la crisis del euro. ¿Por qué tenemos una crisis del euro? Porque es una unidad monetaria sin una unidad política, y no va. Entonces, es el inicio de la caída del euro, creo. Si no queremos más gobernanza a nivel europeo, nadie va a confiar el oro. Entonces no es solo mundial, pero ni siquiera a nivel europeo. Tenemos mucha gobernanza fuerte, suficiente fuerte para luchar contra estas cosas. Seguimos mañana. Último slide de hoy, primero de mañana.